does it take? To defend a nation. A nation of 46 million people. A nation bracing itself against a hostile invasion.
Orders completing the mobilization of the Navy, Army and Air Force were signed by the King at a meeting this afternoon of the Privy Council.
By a ruthless enemy.
There's a fighter over there coming straight down into the sea now. He's just now crashing into the sea, crashed into the breakwater.
In 1940, it took 2,927 pilots.
175 German aircraft had been destroyed in today's raids over this country.
Along with tens of thousands of others supporting them.
The sun was shining from a cloudless sky.
They were Britain's last...
And there was hardly a breath of wind anywhere.
...line...
When I saw three Junkers 88 bombers about 4 miles away...
...of defence. These voices tell an incredible story of how a nation was saved... ...in the sky.
Men will still say... ...this... ...was their finest hour.
This is Battle of Britain 85. Sound Stories. Sound
Stories. Now... Britain stood alone. Britain stood
alone. On September the 3rd, 1939, as the decade drew to an end, so was the fragile peace in Europe. As Britons went about their daily lives, the war was announced by the head of state, Queen Elizabeth's father, King George VI.
In this grave hour, perhaps the most fateful in our history, I send to every household of my people, both at home and overseas, this message, spoken with the same depth of feeling for each one of you, as if I were able to cross your threshold and speak to you myself. For the second time in the lives of most of us, we are at war.
This is London. The following official communique has been issued from 10 Downing Street. On September the 1st, His Majesty's ambassador in Berlin was instructed to inform the German government that unless they were prepared to give His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom satisfactory assurances that the German government had suspended all aggressive action against Poland and were prepared promptly to withdraw their forces from Polish territory, His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom would, without hesitation, fulfill their obligations to Poland. At 9 a.m. this morning, His Majesty's ambassador in Berlin informed the German government that unless not later than 11 a.m. satisfactory assurances to the above effect had been given by the German government and had reached His Majesty's government in London, a state of war would exist between the two countries as from that hour.
As the war started, Britain's future Prime Minister was still the First Lord of the Admiralty. So it was Neville Chamberlain who made the announcement that everyone expected, but no one wanted.
I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
War had begun and the first of many dreadful battles wasn't far away. War broke out. Then, almost nothing happened. People went about their everyday lives. They dug shelters, blacked out their windows, and waited. This was the phony war. Families in London did the unthinkable and sent their children to the country.
Hello, Mum and Dad, don't get worried about us. We're all very happy here and don't think anybody wants to go home yet. We go on the moors nearly every night and we go playing football and watch the colliery. Last week, the boys and girls had a match of netball. There was 14 girls and 3 boys, but the girls won us.
Whilst the government appealed for a home defence force, future Prime Minister and Minister for War broadcast his appeal for volunteers. Anthony Eden.
Sir, the government have received countless inquiries from all over the kingdom, from men of all ages who are, for one reason or another, not at present engaged in military service, and who wish to do something for the defence of their country. Well, now is your opportunity. We want large numbers of such men between the ages of 17 and 65 to come forward now and offer their service in order to make assurance doubly sure. The name of the new force, which is now to be raised, will be the Local Defence Volunteers. This name describes its duties in 3 words. It must be understood that this is a spare time job, so there will be no need for any volunteer to abandon his present occupation.
Children were issued gas masks.
I want you to get your knitting out and settle down comfortably at your desks. And then I want to see just how long you can sit there with your gas masks on. And when you're quite quiet, I'm going to read you a story.
Edward Murrow witnessed the first air raid drill.
This is London calling Columbia, New York. At 9 o'clock this morning, London time, the air raid sirens went off, and it wasn't a pleasant sound. We moved quietly and in orderly fashion down underground. The all clear came in just a little while. An unidentified plane had been seen approaching the coast. It was later found to be a friendly ship. Now, for the last few hours, I haven't had an opportunity to be up on the streets of London to see what is happening. But I have heard one story concerning that air raid siren. When the air raid siren went off, one man began to run. He ran for about half a block. He looked around, saw that no one else was running, and stopped, with perhaps the typical English desire not to be conspicuous.
And the shutdown started. The phony war was coming to an end. The British Expeditionary Force was in France to assist in defending against the German army. The BBC's Richard Dimbleby.
We're standing in the pouring rain at the side of a French road. A road squelching with mud and lined right away over the plain to the far skyline with the inevitable double row of poplars. It's a grey, cold, dismal day. A few lorries only are splashing by to and from the forward areas. But coming down the road towards us is a battalion that I know to be of a famous Irish regiment. They're marching in threes, and in their full battle dress and kit, they blend with the dripping green grass of the roadside and the brown of the haystack.
As they passed us on that road, with their brown capes glistening and their tin hats perched on their heads, I thought how similar this must be to pictures of the last war. The road, the trees, the rain, and the everlasting beat of feet.
The RAF were using the time to get ready, setting up underground operations rooms with illuminated boards showing squadron readiness. Wing Commander Robert Adams was based in the control room in Hornchurch as the enemy started to make incursions.
The days of that phony war were interesting because we were learning a new job. We practiced with our aircraft incessantly, and every now and then the enemy obligingly put in an appearance over the North Sea, and more often than not was successfully engaged. The radio stations round our coast, those tall masts that puzzled people before the war, were able to pick up and identify the enemy. The information was passed to us, and our plotters plotted it with arrows in a great table map below us.
As England saw its first enemy air attacks, the British Expeditionary Force in France was under attack. 25,000 would soon be wounded or dead. As the wave of enemy invasion swept through France towards the English Channel.
And so a thrilling game of hide and seek developed while we waited for the tally-ho.
Blitzkrieg. This was how Nazi Germany scored success in the early years of the war. It means offensive warfare that strikes a swift, focused blow at an enemy using mobile, maneuverable forces. The stage for the battle was set in May 1940, when Hitler's Nazi Germans launched a massive blitzkrieg against Western Europe. Hitler's armies overran Belgium, the Netherlands, and France in only a matter of weeks, leaving Britain as the lone standing Allied power. Between May the 26th and June the 4th, it resulted in Operation Dynamo, a massive effort to evacuate over 50,000 mainly British soldiers hemmed in by the advancing forces on the beach at Dunkirk, where the RAF had a chance to use its few aircraft to help the evacuation.
For days and nights, ships of all kinds have plied to and fro across the channel under the fierce onslaught of the enemy's bombers, utterly regardless of the perils, to bring out as many as possible of the trapped BEF. There was every kind of ship that I saw coming in this morning, and every one of them was crammed full of tired, battle-stained and blood-stained British soldiers. All of them were tired. Some were completely exhausted. But the most amazing thing was that practically every man was reasonably cheerful, and most of them managed a smile. And so the men of the BEF came home.
But here at Dunkirk is another English epic. And to my mind, what was most characteristically English about it? So absurd and yet so grand and gallant that you hardly know whether to laugh or to cry when you read about them. And our great-grandchildren, when they learn how we began this war by snatching glory out of defeat and then swept on to victory, may also learn how the little holiday steamers made an excursion to hell and came back glorious.
Now Britain stood alone, but with the knowledge that a great empire and commonwealth was ranged alongside her.
That a great empire and commonwealth was ranged alongside her.
The Battle of Britain was almost unique. It was named before it had even started. During a speech on June the 18th, Prime Minister Winston Churchill predicted a showdown with Germany when he said,
The battle of France is over. The battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit upland. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
Napoleon, one-time Emperor of France, was well ahead of Hitler. 141 years before Hitler assembled his forces on the French coast to mount an invasion of Britain, Napoleon had done the same thing. Both plans would end with a similar outcome. The problem was, unlike Napoleon, Hitler had air support.
There's nothing to be ashamed of in being frightened. If there were, I oughtn't to be talking to you tonight.
This is the World War I commander of the Tank Corps, General Sir Hugh Jameson Ellis. In early summer 1937, he'd been made Chief of British Civil Defence. Part of his job was to talk to the British people on the radio to boost morale, prepare them for what might come from across the channel.
If you're frightened, try getting angry instead. It's a very good cure for the other thing. A fortnight ago, when I talked about invasion, I gave you two words, stay put. Tonight, I'm going to give you two more, stick it. Day after day, our magnificent young flying boys are going to go up to meet the German airmen and to risk their lives doing it. That needs guts, and they won't, fellas.
It would be miserable if we hadn't the guts to stick it out on the ground. And it will be a crime if you do not take those simple precautions which have been so often urged upon you. Above all, take cover, keep away from your windows, and stick it.
Sir Hugh's boss was also new to his job, and already accomplished at delivering rousing speeches. Winston Churchill knew that, like Napoleon before him, Hitler meant to take Britain for his own rising empire. In response, he delivered one of the finest and most rousing speeches of the war.
When Napoleon lay at Boulogne for a year with his flat bottom boats and his grand army, he was told by someone, there are bitter weeds in England. There are certainly a great many more of them since the British expeditionary force returned. Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government. Every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation, the British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be.
Hitler's plan to invade the British mainland in summer of 1940 faced one obstacle. Germany first needed to annihilate the Royal Air Force and win air superiority over England. Now, the fight for Britain became an all-air contest between the Messerschmitt 109 fighter and British fighter commands Hawker Hurricanes and Supermarine Spitfires. The battle had started. BBC reporter Charles Gardner.
Here they come, an absolute steep dive, and you can see their bombs actually leave the machines and come into water.
It was the
Somebody's hit a German, and he's coming down. There's a long streak, coming down completely out of control, a long streak of smoke. The pilot's bailed out by parachute. He's a Junkers 87, and he's going slap into the sea, and there he goes, smash!
It was the fourth raid yesterday, and we were watching two ME-109s flying out to sea, with AK-AK fire bursting all round them in little Weitenbach puffs of smoke. And suddenly we heard the drone of planes behind us, turned round and saw a line of four fighters. The rear one was a Hurricane. They were flying about a mile inland, parallel with the coast. And as they drew level with one of the balloons of the barrage, the second ME drew out, swerved towards the coast, and made for the balloon coming out of the sun with its machine guns going. It missed the balloon and swerved to the left again towards us here. The air was thick with smoke from a blazing balloon, and tracer bullets from machine guns and pom-poms were cutting through the air. It zoomed down towards us, its guns blazing.
There's a fighter over there coming straight down into the sea now. Flying out over the coast. Suddenly caught into flame, but he's just now crashing into the sea. Didn't crash into the sea, crashed into the breakwater. No, he's not. He's just beyond the sea. There's a tremendous spout of water going up, and a cloud of smoke when he came down.
Soon after that, everything was quiet again, and we waited for the next.
The battle took place above southwest England. The sky was full of contrails, gunfire, the occasional parachute, and unlike battles that had gone before, it was visible to huge numbers of everyday people and sharp-eyed reporters. It was exciting, compelling, but deadly as pilots fought for their country and their lives. A Spitfire or Hurricane were powerful aircraft, but the humans flying them weren't machines. As the battle turned from days to agonizing weeks of raids and dogfights, fatigue set in for the pilots of RAF Fighter Command. The pilots were getting not only tired, but physically and mentally exhausted. Flying several missions a day, during harrowing 15-hour shifts on a few hours of sleep, many took amphetamine pills just to keep themselves awake. But for the microphones and the new media, Fighter Command made sure that pilots were portrayed as cool, calm, and utterly invincible. no matter what happened in the heat of battle.
I had my first parachute descent the other day during a battle off the south coast.
On July the 19th, Flight Lieutenant J.W.C. Simpson calmly, eloquently told his story.
I'd had the pleasure of sending two Messerschmitts into the sea, and then two others attacked me. I twisted and turned, but they were too accurate. I could hear the deafening thud of their bullets. Pieces of my aircraft seemed to be flying off in all directions. My engine was damaged, and I couldn't climb back to the cloud where I might have lost them. Then came a cold, stinging pain in my left foot. One of their bullets had found its mark, some miles out to sea. The wind became my ally, and a hand, actually the slipstream catching under my helmet, seemed to lift me out of the cockpit. It was a pleasant sensation. I was in mid-air, floating down so peacefully in the cool breeze. I could hear the all-clear sirens, and passing over the houses on the seafront, I could see the people coming out of their shelters. Well, the journey ended in a cucumber frame, after I'd pushed myself free of a house with my foot. It was the first time I'd ever bailed out, and really one of the most enjoyable experiences of my life.
The pilots of Fighter Command were achieving extraordinary results against a better-equipped enemy. On September the 15th, the day regarded as the peak of the battle, Sergeant Ray Holmes slammed his Hurricane into a German Dornier bomber who was about to attack Buckingham Palace. He knocked its tail off and had to bail out himself. True bravery and heroism is often wrapped in modesty and quiet humility. Flight Lieutenant J.B. Nicholson was another overworked Hurricane pilot. On August the 16th, he had a day to remember.
That was a glorious day. The sun was shining from a cloudless sky, and there was hardly a breath of wind anywhere when I saw three Junkers 88 bombers about 4 miles away. So I led my section of aircraft round towards the bombers. We chased hard after them, but when we were about a mile behind, we saw the 88s fly straight into a squadron of Spitfires, when suddenly, very close, in rapid succession, I heard four big bangs. And they had been made by four cannon shells from a Messerschmitt 110 hitting my machine. The first shell tore through the hood over my cockpit and sent splinters into my left eye. One splinter, I discovered later, nearly severed my eyelid. I couldn't see through that eye for blood. The second cannon shell struck my spare petrol tank and set it on fire. The third shell crashed into the cockpit and tore off my right trouser leg. The fourth shell struck the back of my left shoe. It shattered the heel of the shoe and made quite a mess of my left foot, but I didn't know anything about that either until later. I gave the Hun all I had, and the last I saw of him was when he was going down, with his right wing lower than the left wing. I gave him a parting burst, and as he disappeared, started thinking about saving myself. Fortunately, it was a very calm day. My parachute just floated down and stayed down without dragging me along, as they sometimes do. I had a piece of good news almost immediately. One of the people who came along and who had watched the combat said they had seen the Messerschmitt 110 dive straight into the sea. So it hadn't been such a bad day after all.
Flight Lieutenant Nicholson was awarded the Victoria Cross by King George VI. Incredibly, his was the only VC awarded to an RAF fighter command pilot during the whole of the Second World War. When the numbers and odds are against you, how do you win a battle? In 1940, the RAF were outnumbered at least 4-1 by the Luftwaffe, headed by Hermann Göring. At the start of the battle, the British had 650 fighters to the Germans' 2,500. Germany's best aeroplane was the Messerschmitt 109 fighter. It was the world's most advanced fighter when it flew in 1935. On the British side, the Hawker Hurricane was regarded as Fighter Command's workhorse. It was teamed with Thoroughbred, the Supermarine Spitfire. In July 1940, the RAF had 29 squadrons of Hurricanes and 19 squadrons of Spitfires. Not enough. So in May, Churchill appointed dynamic Canadian newspaper owner Lord Beaverbrook as Minister for Aircraft Production. 11 Group Commander Air Vice Marshal Keith Park remembered Beaverbrook's determined approach.
Frankly, I was never worried about the supply of aircraft because a chap called Beaverbrook had been put in by Mr. Churchill as head of the aircraft production, and he used to ring up my house every evening at midnight and ask how many aircraft, Hurricanes and fighters had I lost, what replacements were required the next day, long before he rang up, his staff had run up and asked me the same questions 5 or 6 hours earlier, and they were getting on with the replacement. But the fact remains, as the commander on the front line at that time, it was very heartening to have the director of aircraft production ringing up personally every night and without fail.
To build more aircraft, Beaverbrook encouraged people to send money and even pots and pans to help the effort.
We have a flow of contributions coming in, purpose of buying aircraft. Some of the gifts are large, and some of them come from people of limited means. We value the check for £25,000, but we value, too, the gift from the telephone operators at Winchester, who sent us 38 shillings to buy screws for the Spitfire. Then there are those who've given time. In place of your aluminium pots and pans, take the thanks of the builder. To the housewife, who sent us a saucepan. To the British Automatic Company, who sent us 4.5 tons of their valuable metal. If we are put to the trial by fire, we think we can demonstrate that the workers in the aircraft industry will not fail. At our posts we will stay. At our duty we will stand. At our benches we will meet and defeat the enemy who dares to drive liberty from the land of freedom.
By August 1941, the peak of the battle, Britain was producing over 1,000 new fighters every month. At first, Germany's Air Force, the Luftwaffe, only attacked military and industrial targets. In September 1940, something happened that probably saved Britain from invasion. The RAF launched a retaliatory raid against Berlin. The strike sent Hitler into a fit of rage. He demanded that the Luftwaffe erase British cities from the map. This was the beginning of a bombing campaign now known as the Blitz. US reporter Edward Murrow was on London's street as the Blitz began.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid siren. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields. A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance, one single beam sweeping the sky above me now. People are walking along quite quietly. We're just at the entrance of an air raid shelter here, and I must move this cable over just a bit so people can walk in. I can see just straight away in front of me Lord Nelson on top of that thick column. Just a few people here walking rather hurriedly toward the air raid shelters. We've not yet seen any burst of anti-aircraft fire overhead. An air raid warden walks out of this shelter. The shelter here, you know, is the crypt underneath this famous old church just on the edge of Trafalgar Square. The crypt where in days of peace homeless men and women were able to find a night's lodging.
I'm standing on top of a very tall building. I can see practically the whole of London. And if this weren't so appalling, I think it would be one of the most wonderful sights I've ever seen. The whole of the skyline to the south lit up with a ruddy glow, almost like a sunrise or a sunset with white fleecy clouds and a bright orange light behind.
London's underground stations became makeshift air raid shelters.
The platforms themselves absolutely crowded as though it was a cup final, but it isn't a cup final because these people are taking shelter. And I must say, on the whole, they look pretty well satisfied about it. They've got the white line painted along the platform to keep them back from the passengers who have to board these trains, because the service is maintained pretty regularly in spite of the tremendous number of shelters that the LPPB has to house every night now.
The bombing of London on September the 7th was the beginning of weeks of raids that devastated parts of London and other British cities. London burned.
Fire Brigade and Auxiliary Fire Services have done and are doing their usual splendid work, but we must leave them free to fight big fires. The country needs you to see that they have as few fires to fight as possible. Many fire parties are already giving the model and the needed help. We need more still, everywhere. We must quickly get to the point of organization and readiness where not a single incendiary, wherever it falls, has the chance to take firm hold.
The Blitz didn't end with the Battle of Britain. It continued until May 1941. The civilian death toll was chilling. 40,000 people lost their lives, but their lives may have saved millions, because the Blitz was one of Hitler's biggest mistakes, and the battle was about to turn in Britain's favor. Five to one, tough odds. The man in charge of RAF Fighter Command in 1940 was Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding. He famously said, "Our young men will have to shoot down their young men at a rate of 5-1. On the evening of September the 11th, Churchill broadcast to the nation. He was preparing the nation for invasion.
This effort of the Germans to secure daylight mastery of the air over England is, of course, the crux of the whole war. So far, it has failed conspicuously. It has cost them very dear, and we have felt stronger and are actually and relatively a good deal stronger than when the hard fighting began in July. There is no doubt that Herr Hitler is using up his fighter force at a very high rate, and that if he goes on for many more weeks, he will wear down this vital part of his air force. That will give us a very great advantage. If this invasion is going to be tried at all, it does not seem that it can be long delayed. The weather may break at any time. Besides this, it is difficult for the enemy to keep these gatherings of ships waiting about indefinitely while they are bombed every night by our bombers and very often shelled by our warships, which are waiting for them outside. Therefore, we must regard the next week or so as a very important week for us in our history.
But Luftwaffe commander Hermann Göring had made a massive mistake. As the Battle of Britain got underway, he had believed he would easily sweep the RAF aside in just a few days, but the dogfights dragged on for 3.5 long months. On September the 15th, as Germany was distracted by bombing London, for the RAF, the tide turned.
Here is the midnight news, and this is Alvar Lindell reading it. Up to 10 o'clock, 175 German aircraft had been destroyed in today's raids over this country. Today was the most costly for the German Air Force for nearly a month. In daylight raids, between 350 and 400 enemy aircraft were launched in two attacks against London and southeast England. About half of them were shot down. It was officially announced that by 10 o'clock tonight, 175 raiders were known to have been destroyed by our fighters and anti-aircraft gunners.
Hitler's plan to invade Britain across the English Channel, called Operation Sea Lion, was put on hold just a few days later. On the same day, Churchill visited 11 Group Control Room in Uxbridge. By midday, there were 23 British squadrons in the air, matching German air power equally. The battle lasted 5 hours and ended in victory. Over the months that the Battle of Britain had been fought, Germany had lost more than 1,700 planes. Fighter Command alone had lost over 1,000 aircraft, but saved an entire country from invasion.
In July, August and September, 40 or 50 squadrons of British fighter aircraft in the Battle of Britain broke the teeth of the German air fleet at odds of 7 or 8 to 1.
After the Battle of Britain, there was no celebration, no mass jubilation. The battle and the Blitz had turned the phony war into something very real. The battle had been in plain sight for hundreds of thousands to witness.
It's the BBC Home Service. Good morning, everybody. Here is the first news bulletin for today, Friday, January the 10th. And this is Alan Howland reading it. German air attacks on this country last night were widespread but not heavy. There are reports from Germany that our bombers attacked industrial targets there.
The war was very real, as the next few months would reveal. 12 months later, on December the 7th, the US would be attacked at Pearl Harbor.
In this nation's capital, the Japanese attack on Hawaii and the Philippine Islands and the torpedo assault on two American cargo ships in the Pacific have come with an electrifying shock.
Japan entered the conflict.
A state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Japan's long-threatened aggression in the Far East began tonight with air attacks on United States naval bases in the Pacific. President Roosevelt has told the Army and Navy to act on their secret orders, has called a meeting of ministers, and is preparing a report for Congress.
No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
It would be 4.5 years before the Allied forces would cross the English Channel for an invasion plan of their own.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe.
D-Day hadn't even been conceived as this battle came to an end. But Britain had shown its steely determination to never surrender. The events of July the 10th through to October the 31st, 1941, are known in history as the Battle of Britain. The RAF proved to be a better combat force than the Luftwaffe in almost every respect. The decisive factors were British capability and determination, while German mistakes, before and during the battle, contributed significantly to the outcome. It was more than the 3,000 pilots, aircraft production, strategy, and skill that won the battle. It was something more. Something very British.
All our hearts go out to the fighter pilots, whose brilliant action we see with our own eyes day after day. I hope, indeed I pray, that we shall not be found unworthy of our victory if after toil and tribulation it is granted to us. For the rest, we have to gain the victory. That is our task. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
Battle of Britain 85, Sound Stories, is an Original Forces programme for BFBS. It was narrated by Mark Chadwick and written and produced by Andrew Wright. Remembering the extraordinary men and women who defended our islands from invasion, we dedicate this programme to the few.